This is Ken McDermott Rowe. Genocide in Darfur. How did this crisis develop? What does it mean for Sudan and the international community? To discuss these questions, we turn to today's guest, journalist David Morse. In a series of articles over the past 2 years, David Morse has reported on the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Darfur. In his reporting, Mr. Morse had taken a particularly close look at the role played by oil. His articles, including Blood, Ink, and Oil, The Case for Darfur, and War of the Future, have appeared in numerous publications, including Tom Dispatch and Common Dreams. He speaks with us today by telephone from Storrs, Connecticut. Mr. Morse, thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Ken.
To help orient us, can you give us some basic facts about the Sudan and Darfur, where they're located, and some demographic background information?
Well, Darfur is in the western section of Sudan. Sudan is huge. It's 997,000 square miles, which makes it the largest country in Africa, and incidentally one of the poorest. It is in the northeastern part of Africa, dominates what's known as the Horn. So it borders on 9 different countries, including Ethiopia, Eritrea, many cases, countries that are quite unstable. So one of the factors that we have to take into account when we look at the dynamics of Sudan is the way that, in a sense, it is a big exporter of misery. The refugees that flee its instability and violence are themselves destabilizing for the surrounding countries.
Could you outline for us today what the scope of the present humanitarian crisis is in Darfur?
Well, you've got a situation that I guess can be best described as a wholesale slaughter. Whether you use the word genocide is arguable. I use it because it sounds to me like what's happening, that in essence, in Darfur, to the far west, in the far west side of Sudan, you've got Arab militias, which are recruited from kind of the Arab underclass by the government of Khartoum, which is, that is the government of Sudan, which is centered in Khartoum. And these militias are attacking non-Arab, by which we generally mean black African, tribally identified people, those villages, and killing and raping and stealing household goods and stealing cattle and driving the people from their land. They poison wells, they destroy food stocks, they burn over fields.
Is this the John Jaweed militia that people may have heard of?
Yes, exactly. John Jaweed, famously, meaning devil on horseback or evil on horseback.
So they're acting as sort of a front for the central government in Khartoum?
Exactly.
Is there a racial element to the conflict?
Unquestionably. The racial complexion is a bit complicated by the intermarriage that's gone on over generations, so that many of the attackers are very dark. You know, they would look to many of eyes as black, but they self-identify as Arabs, and they identify themselves also by tribe, Bagara and other Arab tribes, whereas the people living in a more sedentary life in the villages, the farming community, identify themselves by the tribe. The predominant tribe, of course, are the Fur. Darfur means land of the Fur.
Well, when the John Jaweed militia attack, are they attempting to dislocate the people, kill them, or do they want to clear the area?
A good question, Ken. They make it. It's a scorched earth kind of situation. They will burn down a village, and then they will come back and burn it again. If people come back and try to rebuild, they will attack again. They will poison wells. They'll throw corpses in wells. Clearly the intent is to clear the land. And that's where I begin to wonder, you know, is this a it's a one-sided war. There are rebels involved, too, so that's one of the arguments that people use against calling it a genocide. There are people who are fighting in the other direction. But the intent of clearing the land, well, it's certainly aimed at extinguishing a culture.
How many people have been killed at this point?
At this point, somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000.
And how many people have been displaced, would you say?
We're looking at probably approaching 2 million.
And what would that represent as a proportion of the population of Darfur?
Well, that would be roughly a third, but in addition to those who've actually been displaced, who are either in refugee camps on the Chad side of the border or other adjoining countries, or who are in internal camps, or who are hiding out in the brush. The ones who've actually been dislocated amount to between 3 and 3.5 million, which would be just about half the population of Darfur.
Now, you've described what's going on in Darfur as the war of the future, quote, a resource war fought by surrogates involving great powers contending for a finite pool of resources. Could you expand on that?
Well, yes. First of all, Sudan itself has oil riches that lie mostly in the south, or up until recently they've been identified as being mostly in the south, and these have been exploited even in the thick of fighting. When American companies left, Chevron left, for instance, when the Civil War, that is the long 22-year-old war between North and South, between Khartoum and the South, which again is a dichotomy of basically Arabic culture and a particularly Islamist, a politically motivated and highly aggressive form of theocracy. That Khartoum, very small elite, and the larger group in the south, kind of lost myself in my sentence, but during that fighting, the oil that was discovered was in the south.
That was in 1978?
Yes. And Khartoum made a grab for it. Chevron was the original discoverer. So Khartoum, through the convenience of redrawing jurisdictional lines, simply drew the line further south to include the oil fields in what they called, ironically, the Unity Province. And the people in the south, of course, who'd been marginalized for generations, they'd always gotten the short end of the stick, were extremely upset at this and went to war. One of the targets actually became the oil facilities. So the American companies and the French companies, Total was a big presence there.
That's a French company?
Yes. It's one of the real giants. It left, after a few people had been killed. And the rebels, knew that they were attacking the Achilles heel when they went after the infrastructure. So eventually Khartoum had to sue for peace. But before that could happen, there was a lot of internal fighting. There was some of the fighting, again, we're talking about the North-South Civil War. During the course of that time, the Chinese came in and built a pipeline, began exploiting the oil with their own security force to protect them. Sometimes these oil, the drilling was going on behind bermed, earthworks. And then, of course, the pipelines had to be guarded constantly from rebel attacks.
So the Chinese had the first pipeline?
Yes.
And where did it go?
It went all the way up to the Red Sea, to Port Sudan, from Cote d'Ivoire. And that's something like, I think it's 1,600 kilometers. It was built in, I'm told, 18 months, a very short span of time, and it was by Chinese workers. When individual workers died, their ashes were sent back to China. It's a very aggressive ploy. It's one that a private company like, Exxon or Chevron wouldn't be able to do.
This is a state-owned Chinese company.
Exactly.
So they've evidently focused on the Sudan as a key source of oil for their expanding economy.
Yes, And it's the Chinese go in with vertical integration, so they are, you know, building a refinery, and they do the pipeline, and they provide the security for their forces, and I think would like Sudan to be a model. The Chinese presence in Africa is very big and growing.
They're also present in Darfur, the Chinese?
They are, yeah. Now, so as not to confuse people, the peace treaty was signed that officially ended the North-South Civil War in January of 2005.
This is the 22-year-long war.
Exactly, yeah. But when that ended, it did not apply to Darfur. In the interest of being able to sign, in fact, they excluded Darfur. And as soon as Sudan's troops were freed from having to fight the North-South War, they moved into Darfur. Now, there were lots of reasons for that that are fairly complex, that involve resources such as water. And the fact that the Sahara is moving south, and places that were previously grazable, where you could bring your camels or your cattle or your horses, were becoming desertified. And as a consequence, there was friction between the semi-nomadic tribes, Arab primarily, and the more sedentary farmers. The camels would come through, or the cattle trample crops, and there was competition for water and that kind of thing. So there was this background of concern, and it had a kind of ethnic cleavage, in that people who had formerly gotten along fine, and again intermarried and so forth, were now more hostile than they had been, and Khartoum really capitalized on that.
So you have the oil has a backdrop of an existing tinderbox.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Then when oil was discovered, it was discovered in South Darfur, in the southeastern corner of the province, and that was quickly a pipeline was built.
Could the Chinese expand their existing operation then? Is that close to
yes.
to the South Sudan area where they started? Yeah.
Yes. And a separate pipeline was built. Let's see, I have that map at hand. The existing pipeline had come from Melut and further south, and it had headed almost straight north through Khartoum, where there's a refinery, and then it went further east to Port Sudan. The new pipeline converges in Khartoum, but it goes to the south, southwest toward Darfur through into Unity province, and then another branch gets built quite recently enough that it simply doesn't appear on earlier maps, but the map I'm looking at now shows a branch that just south of Fula that goes almost due west. And that's what's heading into Darfur.
Now, these are all being built by the Chinese state-owned oil company?
That one is built by a consortium, I think. I would say the Chinese have the lead role.
Now, there have been recent discoveries that have indicated there's even more oil in Darfur in the north?
Well, that's the really remarkable thing, Ken. And there are still people who I'm still having to argue this case with actually someone who's quite expert, and more expert than I, on Sudan. But there have been these recent discoveries, and they've gone virtually unreported. They involve a really strange situation in which an American who changed his citizenship just in time to Hendrik Arnott changed his citizenship in time to legally sign a contract with Sudan.
It was not legal for him to do so as an American?
Exactly. It would have brought him something like a 10-year prison sentence. That would be the maximum.
We have trade restrictions on, the United States has trade restrictions with Sudan.
Yes, those go back. back to the 1997 Clinton era restrictions when Sudan was added to the list of state sponsoring terrorism. Libya was on that list, and Sudan was added on there by Clinton.
So what was Arnot up to?
Well, he first of all runs this company out of it's registered in the and offshore, you know, on the islands, Virgin Islands, and then it has a Swiss business address. He himself lives in Hempstead in London, and I think travels quite a lot. What it meant was it gave him the majority, or at least the primary share, I think something like 37% of a consortium called APCO, in which the other shareholders were Sudanese companies. And that gives him control of a block that runs all the way from Unity Project all the way west to the Central African Republic border. It's a long, skinny thing that kind of arches over Darfur.
Do you suspect he's acting on someone else's behalf?
He could very well, but he will command his price. You know, if he ends up selling his interest, if the Bush administration can get the sanctions dropped, if they can put up a good enough front that you know, that the world can be convinced, and those of us who are advocates for Darfur can be persuaded that you know, that the Khartoum is acting in good faith and so forth, if he can get the existing sanctions dropped, then yeah, he could sell to ExxonMobil.
You mentioned that in the wake of that recent discovery in North Darfur that General Gosh of Sudan had a meeting with American officials.
He did.
What was that about?
Well, the timing of that is very interesting. Ostensibly, you know, this was a secret meeting. It would have taken place at the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. And the interesting thing to me is that it happened just about 1 month after a large discovery was reported, actually in further north in Darfur than the original discoveries, which, you know, I said were mostly in the southeast sector. This was farther north, getting not that far away from Niala, the capital of South Sudan, and when those discoveries were made, it was said to perhaps double the Sudan's oil reserves. So instead of pumping roughly 300 and something thousand gallons a day as they are now, they would have the capacity of pumping, more like 500,000.
Well, now, the United States, in particular Secretary of State Powell, described the Darfur situation as genocide. But on the other hand, Sudan has been called a strategic partner in the war on terror. So where does the United States stand on Darfur?
Well, that's the slippery part, and that's why I think we really have to watch what our government is doing very, very closely. Here you've got an oil discovery reported that suddenly makes Darfur itself attractive, and it makes Sudan a much bigger player in the oil market. And then you've got suddenly this sort of nascent interest on the Bush administration's part in normalizing relationships with Sudan, or at least in developing a cozier relationship with them, in the wake of September 11th. And then you get this secret meeting. The meeting was made public, by a journalist in the LA Times. When that happened, when it was revealed, there was quite a flap inside the State Department. There were some who thought Ghosh should be arrested as a war criminal. I mean, he would have been. He probably is on the list. Something under 50 people. It's been whittled down now a bit, but there was a list that was provided by the United Nations of potential war criminals that would be tried and that could have their assets frozen and so forth.
Well,
so we have not taken the aggressive steps that could be taken. We have not managed to get through one of the provisions that would have had some real teeth.
Could you tell us about the Darfur Peace and Accountability Act? I believe that's been pending.
Yeah.
In Congress.
It was introduced in, I think, March of 2005. And this is the one that provides for, originally in its original form, provided for sanctions extended beyond the existing commercial sanctions that the Clinton administration had had set up. It would have included individual targeted sanctions. Some of the individuals who were responsible for the genocide could have had their assets frozen and the assets of their families frozen. They could have had travel restrictions.
These would be officials in the Khartoum government?
Yes. There actually were some named outside the government officially, the some of the leaders of the Janjaweed.
What has been the Bush administration attitude towards this Darfur Peace and Accountability Act?
Well, it has worked quietly behind the scenes to weaken it. There have been lobbying from the White House, efforts that really succeeded in damaging it as an effective piece of legislation. And I'm not sure all of it's from the White House. You've got a number of representatives and senators who get quite a lot of money from the oil industry.
You said in one of your paper, Blood, Ink, and Oil, the quote, "The war on terror is a red herring to cover the administration's true interest, oil." Could you comment on that?
Well, yes. Let's go back to September of 2004 when Colin Powell made a comment that he said, "There, in my government's estimation, what's going on here is a genocide, but we're not going to act on it because our vital interests are not involved." And that has stood fairly well. People have taken it at face value. And the reason I think they have is because of the Clinton sanctions, those 1997 sanctions. How could American businesses be doing business in Sudan when they would have this hefty jail sentence and a $500,000 fine and so forth? So the assumption was, well, Americans aren't doing business there, and so maybe he's right. And it didn't wash terribly well, but I think most people feel now that it was a pre-election sop to the religious right, who, you know, had missionaries and who were upset that it was primarily Christians, Christians and practitioners of native religions who were being killed by the Muslims.
There had been some dramatic incidents that occurred in the South, I understand, during the Civil War involving the burning of Christian churches and crucifixion of priests. Is that not true?
I don't know about the crucifixion. I had not heard that. But there have been several deaths and displacements and severe attacks, ones where people have been driven first from one place and then another, and that has been largely has been to clear oil fields. A Canadian, it's not just the Chinese, a Canadian company, Talisman Oil, was alleged to have participated in this and to have had the cooperation of the Sudan government and had allowed its roads and airstrips to be used by attackers and provide logistical help and so forth, even participate in the orders.
Are there Chinese soldiers in Sudan?
Yes. I think they're probably called security forces.
Does the United States have any soldiers in Sudan?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
What are the international agencies, the African Union and the United Nations, doing about Darfur?
Well, of course, there's a movement right now, presumably could be led by the U.S., to force Khartoum by hopefully diplomatic means first to accept the African Union force that might be blue helmeted, that might be placed under the command of the UN.
Are there African Union troops there now?
There are. There are about 7,500, but they're not only very few, because remember Darfur it's maybe three quarters the size of Texas. So
yes.
7,500 is, I don't know how that compares to the police force of, a mid-sized American city, but 7,500 is almost nothing to patrol an area that size. In addition, their mandate is extremely narrow. They are prevented from protecting civilians. so they can really only watch. They're not unlike the UN force that was in Rwanda when the genocide went on there.
Is the UN Security Council interested in taking action, and does it require the cooperation of the Khartoum government?
Well, Khartoum has been adamant. It will not accept UN forces. I think in some ways the president, Omar Bashir, has almost put his job on the line. If at this point, if he cannot save face, and if the Security Council does manage to introduce those troops, then he may be uneasy in his position.
It could be done over his objections.
Well, it depends on how you construe the resolution. Most people construe it that, the way it was put was that Khartoum's acquiescence should be obtained if at all possible. I'm not quoting the actual language, but it went something like that. And although that sounds crazy, I mean, you're asking the genocide heirs to approve somebody to come in and stop them from killing, there is a kind of loony wisdom to it, in that Khartoum did accept the African Union force to in its very limited role, and that limited role is better than not having anybody there.
What is Khartoum, one would assume, wants the oil so that it can reap the profits itself, or perhaps share them with the Chinese? What is Khartoum doing with its oil revenues?
Buying arms with about every other dollar. It uses just about half its proceeds from oil to buy weapons. And now they're capable. They have their own, presumably their own tank plant, and they make their own AK-47s with Chinese help.
Does Khartoum see the intervention by the UN as a form of a Western colonization?
Yes, a kind of recolonization. Bashir has used that word. And you know, this is another reason why it would be far more politic to get Khartoum's permission, if at all possible. Khartoum will waste no breath painting this as a as recolonization, and it will put it in, cast it in terms of the Islamo-Christian conflict.
Well, what do you think would be the best avenue to bring about the most quick end to the killings and the displacement of people in Darfur?
Well, we need to have less posturing by our government. In fact, a call was made by the outgoing Assistant Secretary General, the British diplomat, who said, that the UK and United States have to stop this sort of megaphone approach. They're making claims and making threats that they can't possibly deliver on. So what's needed is, I think, the kind of diplomatic effort that the Bush administration does least well, and that's a multi-pronged, collegial effort to jawbone, really, to in a good faith effort to really get down there and get people to go along with a proposal that would, if necessary, bring UN troops without Darfur's consent, into the fray.
Would that involve bringing the Chinese on board?
It would. For it to get past the Security Council, would have to do that.
Now your analysis suggests that this is maybe one example of many resource-driven conflicts. Do you see similar conflicts emerging in other areas?
Well, yes, but before going to that, it's worth pointing out that of the five permanent members of the Security Council, three, let's see, is it five? Do I have that number right? Three are trafficking in oil, have big oil commitments, the UK, France, and China. And two of them are selling, at least two are selling weapons. The French are involved as well. So to get something through the Security Council is going to be difficult, and it does, that's why people want to try to get some level of cooperation with Khartoum.
So no one's coming to this with clean hands?
Nobody. Nobody.
And where else do you see conflicts like this happening?
Well, certainly something similar is playing out in Chad, and some of it is triggered by the things going on in Darfur, because as rebels, for instance, Chadian
Chad is the country just to the west.
Yes, yes. Right. So it shares a long border with Darfur. And there are some people who feel that one of the ways that this is playing out in Darfur is an effort within Sudan and also potentially involving French interest and Libyan ambitions. You know, there's sort of a history of outside intervention, but also internally within within Sudan and even within the clique that runs things in Khartoum to have a regime change to replace Bashir. So they're making it hot for him, and again, oil is playing a huge role in Chad. Chad has no real other exports that I'm aware of. There may be some, but they're slender compared to the new riches of oil.
So this, as long as there's oil in the ground, there's going to be a fight by the developed countries to get control of that oil for their own economies, and probably the least likely people to benefit are the people who sit on top of the oil.
Yes, and somewhere between those extremes are the rebel forces who want some of the action, and some of that is passionately on behalf of their people, and there's another part that unquestionably is probably self-interested.
Well, Mr. Morris, where can people learn more about the crisis in Darfur?
There are a couple of websites, but let me mention a couple of books first, because I think they really would open the doors to people who want to learn something about it. For somebody fairly casually who wants a book that's pretty pretty small and but just well written and compact, Julie Flint and Alex DeWall's book Darfur, A Short History of a Long War, is good. And for somebody who doesn't mind a slightly more scholarly approach, but also has very good information in it, is Gerald Prunier's, that's P-R-U-N-I-E-R, his book, Darfur, The Ambiguous Genocide.
And websites?
I'll give you the website of a website called chickenbones.org, I believe it is, which has a review of mine that I would invite anybody who is interested in Darfur to take a look at, because it does say both describes the conflict and talks about these two books. I believe it's chickenbones, one word, .org.
And also, your articles have been published in a variety of websites. Where would be the best website to go to find your articles?
I would take you right to Tom Dispatch, where they originally appeared. They've also, though, been reprinted on Common Dreams and Alternet. And
that's Tom Dispatch, one word, .com?
Yes, tomdispatch.com.
And commondreams.org?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Morris.
Let me give you one last website, if we can. Eric Reeves has something called www.sudanreeves.org, and he's good.
Well, thanks very much. We've enjoyed speaking with you, Mr. Morris.
My pleasure. Thanks.